Let's pray. Heavenly Father, we are grateful for stories and stories that charm us and thrill us and also inspire us. And we're grateful for story writers. We have been looking at one story writer who's meant so much to each of us, C.S. Lewis. And thank you. Thank you for what we've been able to read together and think about together. So bless us tonight as we look at the stories we love to hear. In Christ's name we pray. Amen. First of all, I want to say before I go any further, the stories we're going to talk about tonight, the Chronicles of Narnia, really deserve to be read aloud. They're written in short sentences. Lewis always said, write for the ear, don't write for the eye. It certainly is true for the Chronicles of Narnia. As you saw last week, it's also true for the Screwtape Letters. You know, John Cleese has the whole Screwtape Letters on tape. If you want to hear one of the great English actors and comedians, he's the creator of the Monty Python Flying Circus. And John Cleese, who I think is one of the funniest guys in comedy, has put all of these Screwtape Letters on CD. And you can just, you realize, it just sounds so wonderful to hear Lewis read aloud. Oh, can I give an ad? I'm living in an apartment house that the church has rented for me right next to the Bethesda Theater. And the Bethesda Theater right now has a wonderful show. I saw it last Saturday. It's called Pluck. It's about the little orchestra that played on the Titanic while it sank. These three young men, well, two men and a woman, I shouldn't give it away, but they are incredible musicians, and it is a hilarious and sensitive and tender show. It would be great for the whole family, but I saw it. I just think it's terrific. So since I saw that show, and I think it's worth seeing, I gave you a plug. Pluck. Plug for Pluck. It's a wonderful show. You get a big kick out of it, and kids would enjoy it, too. You have to explain to the whole history of the Titanic to make sure you understand. They have a lot of film footage in the show about the Titanic itself, so it makes sense. Anyway, these stories should be read aloud. And when they're read aloud, I don't think they should be interpreted to kids when you're reading them. I think you should let the story flow over their heads and through their heads and through their lives. And I don't think what you should do with the Chronicles of Narnia is read away and say, okay, now, do you see all the biblical allusions there? And do you see all... Don't do that. Don't worry. The kids themselves will do that for you. But let the stories flow as a story. In fact, I would say that same thing with Lord of the Rings. I would say the same thing with any story. Let the story come over you. And that's my advice. And the Chronicles of Narnia are so marvelous to read aloud. They're wonderful to read if you have somebody that can read in the car without getting carsick. And that was my wife. My wife could read without getting carsick. So we've had so many stories read to us while we drive our car in all those years where our kids were growing up. To hear these stories being read is such a wonderful, wonderful experience. So, and we developed a little trick in our family. I love to do the dishes anyway, and so on our vacations, I said, well, you know, you kids, shouldn't you be doing the dishes? Aren't children supposed to? If I do the dishes, then while I'm doing the dishes, Shirley will read aloud, and then when the dishes are over, then you can leave. They couldn't go out and play until the dishes were done. So since I like to do the dishes anyway, they all lay around the floor, and Shirley would read. And that's how we conned all of our kids into having stories read. And after a while, I'll tell you what happened. You can imagine what happened. After the dishes are done, then they are legally able to leave because they only had to stay till the dishes were done because they'd have to do that anyway. But you know what happened? The dishes would all be done, and the kids would say, hey, Mom, one more chapter, please. And that became a famous line in our family. One more chapter. Please, one more chapter. The story begins to take over. The story gets a hold of your life. That's how you can con your kids and adults into having a story read aloud. All right, let me say, first of all, read a couple of things that Lewis wrote about these stories. He didn't say too much about the stories he wrote, but in answer to some letters, he did say this. In 1962, he wrote this to a friend. I turned to fairy tales because that seemed the form which certain ideas and images in my mind seemed to demand, as a man might turn to fugues because the musical phrases in his head seemed to be good fugal phrases. When I wrote Lion, that's Lion, Witch, and Wardrobe, I had no notion of writing the others. That's good that that's all clear. Writing juveniles, stories for children, certainly modified my habits of composition. Thus, it imposed a strict limit on vocabulary. It excluded erotic love. It cut down reflective and analytical passages. And it led me to produce chapters of nearly equal length for the convenience in reading aloud. All these restrictions did me great good, like writing in strict meter. That's an interesting comment that he made. And then another letter he wrote to a little girl. A girl wrote him a letter in 1959 and asked him what the significance was of who Aslan was. And he says, I don't think, she said, did you know what Aslan was going to do when you wrote it? And she says, I don't think I foresaw what Aslan was going to do and suffer. I think he just insisted on behaving in his own way. This, of course, I did understand, and the whole series became Christian. But it is not, as some people think, an allegory. That is, I didn't say, let us represent Christ as Aslan. I say, supposing there was, this is a famous line from Lewis, where he explained his theological intention, supposing there was a world like Narnia, and supposing, like ours, it needed redemption, let us imagine what sort of incarnation and passion and resurrection Christ would have there. In other words, I wondered what the Redeemer would be like, given a place like Narnia. And then he says, I think this is pretty obvious if you take all seven Narnian stories as a whole. In Magician's Nephew, Aslan creates Narnia. In Prince Caspian, the old stories about him are beginning to be disbelieved. At the end of Dawn Treader, he appears as a lamb. His three replies to Shasta, remember I read Shasta aloud, of the Horse and His Boy a few weeks ago, suggest the Trinity. Remember when he says, who are you? He says, myself, myself, myself. It's almost like Moses with the burning bush. In The Silver Chair, the old king is raised from the dead by a drop of Aslan's blood. Finally, in the last battle, we have the reign of Antichrist, the ape, and the end of the world and last judgment. So anyway, Lewis did give those reflections to a young schoolgirl that asked him what he was trying to do in the Chronicles. Well, he wrote Lion and Witch and Wardrobe. He wrote it, first of all, for Lucy Barfield, who is the daughter of his great friend, Owen Barfield. And that's why Lucy becomes the main character in the Chronicles of Narnia. And here's what he wrote to Lucy when he wrote Lion. I wrote this story for you, but when I began it, I had not realized that girls grow quicker than books. As a result, you are already too old for fairy tales. And by the time it is printed and bound, you'll be older still. But someday you'll be old enough to start reading fairy tales again. You can then take it down from some upper shelf, dust it, and tell me what you think of it. I shall probably be too deaf to hear and too old to understand a word you say, but I shall still be your affectionate godfather, C.S. Lewis. So that's the introduction to Lion. All right. Why are these stories so loved? These seven stories he wrote starting in 1950, in the full maturity of his life, and why are they so loved? He once said to a friend, I decided to write stories like I always wanted to read. And so he started writing them. I'll make a reflection that Lewis himself made in an article he wrote about Hamlet. In one of the collections of his essays, he was, of course, as you know, a great literary critic. And he has one brilliant essay on Hamlet, the play by William Shakespeare. In that, he kind of goes through all the various deconstruction interpretive models of Hamlet, the Oedipal complex model, the various models of interpretive handling of Hamlet. And he rejects them all. And he says the one thing that they missed in all these interpretations of Hamlet, especially the psychologized interpretations of Hamlet, is, and then here's a great line from Lewis, what they missed in all of these is, quote, that the play is above all else interesting. In other words, it's a darn good story. And he said, they missed that. That's the key to Hamlet. It's a darn good story. And Lewis wrote darn good stories. These are darn good stories. That's the first reason why the Chronicles of Narnia are loved. They're just darn good stories. Secondly, because it's a story of the marvelous. The marvelous story, that's a phrase he coined, the stories of the marvelous, both for his work and the work of Tolkien as well, in which we're invited to use our imagination and to wonder beyond the world we think we know so well. Owen Barfield, when he was analyzing his two friends, Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien, he said, Lewis is a man captured by his imagination. Tolkien is a man captured by language. And that's true of both of them. They both were captured by imagination, but language was the key for Tolkien. He created Middle Earth. He created a whole vocabulary, a whole language for Middle Earth. Lewis was not so important on that. That wasn't so important for him. He was mainly totally caught up with the stories of the marvelous, his imagination. And now some people are bothered by this, and I want to just cover this at the very beginning. Some people think that stories of the marvelous and stories that invite you to use your imagination to create myth and create magic and all of this are dangerous for young minds. And some people say young minds should not be reading these stories of the marvelous or these stories like, for instance, the Lloyd Alexander series, The Turan Wanderer, or the J.R. Tolkien, Lord of the Rings, with all the witches and magic and all the things that are in it. And, of course, J. Rowling's Harry Potter. Some people say, oh, you shouldn't read those. There's witchcraft and all the rest. I don't agree with those people at all. I agree with Lewis that more dangerous stories for kids are the so-called realistic stories. It's more dangerous to watch the TV show Friends than it is to read the Chronicles of Narnia or to read J.R. Rowling, Harry Potter, because Friends have people living all kinds of reckless lifestyles with no consequences. And that's supposed to be realistic. That's supposed to be the way the world is. No, it's not. And yet these stories create imaginative imagery that kids are able to work with and they're able to handle that. I really do believe it's true. Now, I'm going to read two things before we start the stories that J.R. Tolkien wrote and Lewis wrote about fantasy stories. These are called fantasy stories, or Tolkien called them fairy stories, fairy tales. Tolkien says this, "For the moment I shall say only this." This is in a great book. These are essays presented to Charles Williams, edited by C.S. Lewis, which has a great chapter by J.R. Tolkien on fairy stories, fairy tales, and then a great chapter by Lewis, too, and also by Dorothy Sayers and others. But here's Tolkien's comment. "For the moment I will say only this, a fairy story is one which touches on or uses fairy, in other words, magic, whatever its own main purpose may be. Satire, adventure, morality, fantasy. Fairy itself may perhaps most nearly be translated by the word magic. But it is magic of a peculiar mood and power. At the farthest pole from the vulgar devices of the laborious scientific magician, there is one proviso." Now listen to this. This is a very interesting warning from J.R. Tolkien. "There's one proviso. If there is any satire present in the tale, one thing must not be made fun of, and that is the magic itself." In other words, you shouldn't tell a story like the Chronicles of Narnia and be making fun of the fact they walked through a wardrobe door. Whoever heard of walking through a wardrobe door into the winter? Don't make fun of that. That's the magic. That's the imaginative magic. Don't mock it. Especially don't do that if you're reading it to a child and say, ah, this is so ridiculous. Santa Claus riding on a sleigh with miniature reindeer. Don't do that. Let it stand. Don't deconstruct it. Read the Clement Moore, The Night Before Christmas, and just open up to the wonder of it all. It's a great story. Let the story be the story, okay? So you must not make fun of the magic. How could miniature reindeers, how could Santa Claus get down a smokestack? Gee, I tell you, let him do it. You know. In other words, don't make fun of the magic itself. That must, in the story, be taken seriously. It must neither be laughed at or explained away. Okay, that's J.R. Tolkien. It's a warning as you read his stories. Now, Lewis himself. Lewis spoke to it, too, in a wonderful way. "The necessary condition of all good reading," Lewis said, "is to get ourselves out of the way." See, that's why adults to try to demythologize Santa Claus in Clement Moore's The Night Before Christmas are making a big mistake. "The necessary condition of all good reading is to get ourselves out of the way. We do not help the young to do this by forcing them to keep on expressing opinions. Especially poisonous is the kind of teaching that encourages them to approach every literary work with suspicion. It springs from a very reasonable motive. In a world full of sophistry and propaganda, we want to protect the rising generation from being deceived, to forearm them against the invitations to false sentiment and muddled thinking, which printed words will too often offer them. Unfortunately, the very same habit which makes them impervious to the bad writing may also make them impervious to the good writing. The excessively," and now Lewis, who's a great illustrator, comes up with a marvelous illustration. "The excessively, quote, knowing rustic," you know, a rustic would be a boy from the country, "who comes to town too well primed with warnings against con artists, does not always get on very well. Indeed, he, after rejecting much genuine friendliness," see, watching out for the con artist, "and missing many real opportunities, and making several enemies, he is quite likely to fall victim to some trickster who flatters his shrewdness. And as you know, the great pigeon drop con that's used with people about that your bank is trying to steal your money. Let's test. I'm a bank inspector. I'll help you test to see if your bank is... I thought my bank was stealing my money. And then you go in and that's the best con there is for getting the people to withdraw their money from their bank so that you can test to see if the bank is stealing. And then, of course, it's the con artist who steals it from. That's called the pigeon drop. And so the trickster flatters your shrewdness. So here, now this is vintage Lewis. Listen, no poem will give up its secret to a reader who enters it regarding the poet as a potential deceiver and determined, therefore, not to be taken in. We must risk being taken in if we are to get anything. The best safeguard against bad literature is a full experience of good literature. Just as a real and affectionate acquaintance with honest people gives you a better protection against rogues than a habitual distrust of everyone. Isn't that vintage? That is great, C.S. Lewis, from his book, Experiment and Criticism. One of the last books Lewis wrote, by the way, just before he died, is Experiment and Criticism. All right. So these are stories of the marvelous, and Lewis says, let them come across you. Don't be too clever in saying, this couldn't be, that couldn't be. No, do that. Just let the story flow. All right. There's two reasons, then, why these stories are so fun. One, because it's a good story. Two, because they're stories of the marvelous that actually stir up your imagination and get you to imagine a lion that can talk and a mouse with a sword who is talking mouse. Lewis loved talking mice. A horse that can talk, like Brie and Hui. And then all of these wonderful things are so improbable, and yet your imagination sees them happen. Three, because the characters we meet who catch our attention, we care about. I always say that's one of the marks of any great story is there are no throwaway characters. The characters interest you. The characters that you meet actually do stir you up and become interesting to you. And that's true in the Chronicles of Narnia. It's true in the Lord of the Rings, too. Four, because the emotional and even spiritual feelings that we discover while we're reading, we care about. Courage, fear, loyalty, truth-telling, betrayal, and then the healing of brokenness. All those are things that we see happen in great stories. We care about those things. We care about every one of those things. And so that makes the story so that we like it. And then five, and here is the biggie. Because C.S. Lewis, and also J.R. Tolkien, also J.J. Rollins in Harry Potter, and Lloyd Alexander, who's another one of my very favorite writers of stories for children and adults, and Mark Twain, who I think is America's greatest writer, they dared to confront the two most important themes in literature, the problem of evil and the possibility of good. The power of good, the power of evil. And they're confronted. Lewis sees the complexity of what Tolkien called the catastrophe. Remember the first night we were together and Lewis, I told about how he became a Christian. Because Tolkien said in all good stories, there's got to be a sense of catastrophe. And you catastrophe. In Greek, put an EU in front of a word, it means good. Good catastrophe. And the good catastrophe is stronger than the catastrophe. In every great story, good is more powerful than evil. All that came from the Bible, where Paul said in Romans 5, where sin increased, the grace of God increased more. You know, that is the good news, folks. Not that there is an evil, and not that evil is not powerful. It is powerful. Sin increases. It's cumulative. There's a cumulative power in evil. But the cumulative power of grace is greater. I think that's one of the greatest sentences in all the Bible. In fact, Karl Barth says chapter 5 of Romans is the most important chapter in the whole Bible. Where sin increased, the grace of God increased more. Wow. And Lewis saw that. Tolkien saw it. That there is the problem of evil that has to be faced, the catastrophe. It's complex. It's never simple. And the reality of ultimate good, which is stronger. It's also complex. So Let me, before we let Lewis speak for himself, I'm going to have a wonderful reading for you tonight, which we'll close with, in which you'll see some of these things. But I'm now going to take you on a journey through the Chronicles and some of the other things Lewis also wrote and show you how he worked with these. First, the human and cosmic crisis is not uncomplicated. And there is a spectrum. There's a graduated scale. And Lewis saw that with regard to the problem of evil. He faced the problem of evil. All the great writers do. Of course, the great Russian writers, Victor Hugo in the Les Miserables, all great writers have to cope and face up to the problem of evil. In the Chronicles of Narnia, you meet it right away when you enter Narnia in the Lion, Witch, and Wardrobe. And the first sign of evil is what we might be called garden variety biblical understanding of sin, which is seen mainly armatia, the Greek word for sin, the common word for sin, literally means to miss the mark or to be weak, weakness. We see that weakness. We see it in Tumnus himself. Tumnus is the first character in Narnia we meet. And we discover Tumnus is a good guy, good fawn, but he is weak. He's frightened. Right away, he knows that the Winter Queen has told him to report. There have been the words out to report any of the sons or daughters of Adam that might show up in Narnia. And he recognizes little Lucy as a daughter of Adam. And so right away, he decides to give her some tea that's got something in it that's going to make her go to sleep. Then he can betray her and give her over to the wicked queen. But he can't follow through with it. But that weakness, that's garden variety sin. In the Bible, the common word for sin, armatia, means to miss the mark. It's just weak. Lewis saw that. And it's interesting that his first character and the first sign of evil is in Tumnus himself. Then it begins to graduate. It moves up. By the way, in other writers, I think of Joseph Conrad, one of my very favorite of all. I've tried to read all of Conrad's works, who was a tremendous writer. He was Polish. He wrote in English, but he wrote beautiful English. And one of his greatest novels is Lord Jim. It's interesting to me that this Polish writer in Lord Jim, his protagonist, the main character, is a young, red-headed, Scottish boy who's the son of a Presbyterian minister. Why would this Roman Catholic, Joseph Conrad, one of the greatest writers of the last century, why would he choose as his main character in Lord Jim a Presbyterian boy, red-headed kid from Scotland? But as you know, he's a sailor in the Far East, and he's on a ship, the Patna, and on that ship he's the second officer, and the captain in that ship carrying a bunch of Chinese workers that are being transported. And the ship goes into a storm, and a terrible storm. And, of course, he wrote Typhoon. He wrote a lot of books about it. You know, Joseph Conrad was at sea for a large of his life. And in the storm, they realize the ship is in danger of completely falling apart. And so the captain and a couple of his officers decide to take one of the few lifeboats that's still secured, and they take it knowing that the ship is going to go down. And so they take the lifeboat and they come into shore. They arrive safely at shore and tell the horrible story that in the terrible storm, their ship, the Patna, went down. And there were many lives lost because there were so many Chinese workers on board the ship. But we did all we could do. We could not save any of them. And here's Lord Jim, this young man, with the captain as they come into shore. And you can imagine what happened the next day when the ship came in. These Chinese workers were able to secure the ship, and they brought it in without a captain, without a first officer. The officers, unlike the officer of the Titanic who went down with the ship, they didn't. Then the rest of the novel, Lord Jim, is of this boy who had that sin of weakness. He simply wanted to survive, and so he abandoned the ship. And all the rest of that novel is this boy, and there's that line that Conrad puts in. He could not go back to Scotland because he had contaminated the earth with his cowardice. It's a sad, sad story. It's a sad novel. But it's weakness. It's Tumnus who feels so much regret, starts to weep, actually, when he realizes that he's drugging this girl, and then he can't go through with it. But it's weakness. And that's Lewis portrays that in the Chronicles. And then there's the confusion of values, where sin begins to become more complicated. And we see that in Edmund. We meet Edmund right away. And Edmund is literally enamored and tempted with Turkish Delight. I don't even like Turkish Delight myself. Except I have to admit in the movie it looks so good, the Turkish Delight. because it's a wonderful confection, but it has perfume in it. I can't understand why the Turks love it so much, because imagine having candy with perfume in it. It's an applet or a cotlet with perfume in it. But it does look awfully good in Lion, Witch, and Wardrobe. And Edmund only gets one taste of it. He never gets any more from the Queen. But that was so wonderful. And the Queen is so beautiful. And you know, Swinden, who played that part in the movie, she was wonderful. She is so beautiful, wearing these huge robes. And she has an ugly little assistant. But she is absolutely beautiful. And he's totally enamored by her. And she hugs him, and he gets warm in the sleigh for a moment. And his values are all confused. They're so confused that when he sees that Tumnus's house has been destroyed, he says, well, he must have deserved it. His sympathies and all are dulled by this fact of confusion of values. That's what temptation does. Temptation confuses your values so that you choose, as Lewis says, you choose the lower value instead of a higher one. And then you have an ever-increasing appetite for an ever-decreasing pleasure. Notice, he gets no more Turkish delight after that. But yet, that confusion of values, Lewis saw that sin moves through a kind of journey. It moves through a journey of complexity, so it goes to that. And then the preoccupation with myself becomes a huge portrayal of another level of human sin, where I become totally focused on myself. Eustace in Voyage of Don Treader is a perfect example of that. We meet him early on, and all Eustace can think about is himself. He makes fun of the voyage of the Don Treader, the ship. He makes fun of Prince Caspian, who's so marvelous. She makes fun of the English children, who were his cousins. And he is only thinking of himself. And as a result, he kind of runs away from the ship instead of doing his job and ends up going into a dragon's cave to get a bunch of wonderful gold that he found for himself. And he puts all those rings on his arm because I want to keep all those rings. And then he falls asleep in a dragon's cave, not knowing great stories that you should never fall asleep in a dragon's cave. Because if you fall asleep in a dragon's cave, you'll turn into a dragon yourself. And when he does, his arm hurts so bad because the gold rings that he put around his arm to take back now are so tight that it's cutting off his blood. So Lewis is so marvelous the way he portrays this gradual crescendo, that this preoccupation with myself, making sure that I get my money, that I get what I want, and it has that growing intensity. By the way, the superhero of the Chronicles is also not impervious to it, Lucy. In the magic book, when she gets to look in the magic book in Voyage of Don Treader, she sees her friends back in England making fun of her. And she says, well, you won't have me to make fun of anymore. Again, she sees everything in terms of herself. And guess what happens? She hears the growl of Aslan the Great Lion. And she realizes that she is focused on herself. And Aslan has to teach her a lesson that her friends are just being weak. But they still really are her friends. She can't, because she saw that weakness, she can't focus everything on what she felt about how she had been let down by those friends. It's marvelous. That's a marvelous scene in Voyage of Don Treader. Then human sin moves to another level, and that's treachery and betrayal, what the Bible calls wickedness. You know, the word wicked, which Paul uses in Romans, is worse than just armatia. It's a more toxic decision to actually get even with somebody that maybe is your threat. And so Edmund becomes a traitor to his own brother, Peter, and Susan and Lucy in Lion, Witch, and Wardrobe, and decides that he will try to help the Winter Queen because he's been so enamored by her, but he will try to bring them in so that she can have them. And, of course, he can't do it. He tries to do it, but that is betrayal. Then there is an evil that's even worse than all of this, and that is Lewis's portrayal of cosmic evil. And I already read to you last week his comments in Screwtape Letters about the devil. It's interesting. He sees the demons, the devil. It's very important. Lewis's theology, I think, is totally in the biblical model. He doesn't see the devil, he's not dualistic. He doesn't see the devil as co-equal with God or having been eternal like God. No, the devil's a part of created order. But it's a part of the created order at the cosmic level of creation, which is a mystery to us, that has gone against God. That's how I define the devil, as moral will against the will of God at the cosmic level of creation. Like our sins are our will against God at our level of creation. But the devil is a fallen angel That's the way the Bible portrays the devil, and that's the way Lewis does. And you remember I read those quotations last week from Screwtape Letters where he makes that clear. So the cosmic evil is, it knows the truth and the true center, and yet it chooses against that true center. It's interesting, it knows the source of good, but has chosen against the source of good. Tolkien in Silmarillion does the same thing in his portrayal of the evil in the creator of the ring and the Aeron against true good in the Lord of the Rings. So this angelic will against the will of God is cosmic evil. And so Lewis sees all that sort of gradient scale. And in the Chronicles of Narnia, he has all those kinds of problem of evil portrayed. But best of all, he portrays ultimate good, what Tolkien called the good catastrophe, as knowable, personal, concrete, totally good, and more powerful than evil, but also not apparently so powerful to us when we first see it, especially in the times of our temptation. But that personal good is seen in the great golden lion Aslan, son of the emperor. That's how he describes him in the Chronicles of Narnia, son of the emperor from beyond the sea. Now, how do we notice and discover good? There's also a kind of a graduated discovery journey. We discover this ultimate good first by our own wanderings and our own longings and our questions and what we are yearning to find. Lewis saw that. It was true in his own life that if you read his book, Surprised by Joy, he had a journey in which he was searching for joy, searching for that meaning. So that search itself is the beginning of the journey. And Lewis sees that. And you see it also in characters in the Chronicles of Narnia. And then there are signs. Now, the signs are very interesting in Chronicles of Narnia. The first sign, when we enter Narnia, we realize it's been winter, no Christmas, but winter for many, many years, because of the power of the Winter Queen, who has evidently a complete grip of power upon Narnia. Therefore, it has this total frozenness. By the way, it's interesting that he decides to make evil frozen rather than hot. He follows Dante in that point. The devil in Dante is cold, not hot. We think of Dante's fires, but no, it's cold. Evil is cold. And Lewis saw that. So you have the Winter Queen is cold. But notice the coldness makes everything she does has more power. Her sleigh works beautifully on the cold snow. If you've done skiing or anything, you know the colder the snow, the better the snow, the better it is for a sleigh. And so the first sign that Aslan is moving in the east is the thaw. And it's interesting that when it begins to thaw, it becomes muddy and very hard on the sleigh. The sleigh has a very hard time moving when the thaw is underway. And that is sort of the sign. There's a sign that good is coming. And the first sign is the thaw. And then another sign is the witness that's given by these wonderful creatures, these talking creatures in Narnia, the witness they give that son of the emperor from beyond the sea is moving in the east. And he decides to let Mr. and Mrs. Beaver play that role. And Mr. and Mrs. Beaver, who are knowing little characters, and I liked, by the way, what the movie did. It seemed to me the movie had a huge challenge on their hands. What do you do with Mr. and Mrs. Beaver? And they decided to make them almost like little Brooklyn characters, really funny and very comic characters in the movie, and I felt that was a very good choice. And they decided to take away from Mr. and Mrs. Beaver the best line in all of the Chronicles of Narnia, and decided to give that to the very end of the movie. Aslan is not a tame lion, but he's good. They decide to save that great line, which is given to Mr. and Mrs. Beaver in the story. But they save that for the end. But Mr. and Mrs. Beaver get to bear witness to these children that Aslan is moving in the east. He's the son of the emperor from beyond the sea, I tell you. Well, Susan says, well, then it should be wonderful to meet him. I should be glad to meet him. Who is he? Oh, he's a lion. Oh, is he quite safe? And then they get to say, oh, no, he's not safe. But then the last line of the whole story, they don't get to get there. He's not safe, but he's good. But they, and then Lucy says, I don't know if I want to meet him because if he's not safe. But he's not, he's wild. He's a wild lion. he's not safe. But Mr. and Mrs. Beaver get to give witness. And so you get that sense of witness being given. Lewis saw that because in his own life, there were people who played a key role in bearing witness to him in his own journey. Even Shasta gets to give witness in Horse and His Boy, the passage I read to you from Horse and His Boy the first night. And in Horse and His Boy, Shasta says, "Are you a giant?" Now, I let that line pass by when we read it because I don't want to stop a story in order to interpret. But when Aslan meets him on the path and he says, "Are you a giant?" It's interesting how Aslan answers him. Aslan says, "You may call me a giant, but I'm not like the creatures you call giants." Remember, Shasta grew up, or Tashban, he grew up in a place of just sheer superstition, spooky superstition. And so he doesn't have any background. But he knows that there are these giants that he's worried about. And there's giants in Narnia. And so when Aslan meets him on the path, he says, "Are you a giant?" Then Lewis has Aslan answer, "You might call me a giant." Now notice, he does not reject Shasta's words. Lewis is very big on language. And you know, Lewis is no fool. You think about it for a minute. The Hebrew Bible, when it first introduces us to God, uses three Hebrew words to identify God. Elohim, which is the Hebrew, the same word that in Arabic is Allah. So the Islamic world and the Jewish world and the Christian world, we worship the same God, Allah, Elohim. Elohim, El Shaddai, and Adonai, the three great words that are used in the Hebrew Bible for God. And they're translated the God of our fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Elohim, Adonai, El Shaddai. Did you know that all three of those words basically mean giant? So Lewis says, "You can call me giant." Notice, he has Aslan say that. Yes, it's okay to call God giant. The Hebrew Bible does. But when God meets Moses at the burning bush, he doesn't call himself Adonai, El Shaddai, or Elohim. What's he call himself? "I am who I am. I will be who I will be." In other words, I speak for myself. And so when Moses goes to the children of Israel, what does he say? "The God of your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, met me at the burning bush, and his name is Yahweh." He is. That's a third person singular to be verb. He is. He speaks for himself. And that becomes the holy name for God for the rest of the Old Testament. He is. It's from I am, see? That's how God identifies. And notice in the Horse and His Boy, he says, "Are you a giant? You can call me a giant, but I'm not like the creatures you call giants." In other words, no word you can come up with can capture who God is. Isn't that marvelous? Yet it is a witness. It's a witness from the Hebrew Bible. It's a witness from us as to what God is. He's giant. He's big. He's huge. Wow. He's awesome. Kids love to use that word. Yes. Yet he speaks for himself. And he's not captured by that word. There's no words that can capture him. He is who he is. He speaks for himself. And that's what gets you ready for the Gospel of John and all the I am statements of our Lord in the New Testament, where John will say, "In the beginning was the Word, the speech. The Word was with God. The Word was God. And the speech became flesh and dwelt among us, full of grace and truth." See, that's who God is. Now, so Lewis saw that and he puts it in his story. But he puts it in the most priceless way. "Are you a giant?" "Yes, you call me a giant." God lets us call him a lot of things. By the way, he's not easily offended. He's not easily offended. "Call me a giant, but I'm not like the creatures you call giants." "Well, then who are you?" And remember then what Aslan says to him, "Myself, myself, myself." See, I am, I am, I am. Okay. And then finally, self-disclosure. The self-disclosure when Aslan makes himself known, "Myself, myself, myself." Well, there you have it. That's what we meet in these wonderful stories. And the stories take us on a journey. I have to tell you right now that I don't agree with Douglas Gresham, who's the stepson of C.S. Lewis, who now is the controller of the C.S. Lewis estate. And when he had the Chronicles of Narnia published, he decided to make Magician's Nephew Volume 1. So if you buy the Chronicles of Narnia, you'll get Magician's Nephew as number 1, volume number 1. It's not. It's actually volume number 6. Number 1 should be Lion, Witch, and Wardrobe. And I think you should read them in the order that he wrote them, frankly. And I'm glad that when Disney decided to put the movies out with Walden, they just started with Lion, Witch, and Wardrobe first. That's the one to begin. And then you get the wonderful joy of getting to Magician's Nephew, which I love, where Creation of Narnia occurs. And there you get to see it as a flashback, so to speak, the way Lewis does. He gives you a flashback in Magician's Nephew to help you understand the creation of Narnia, this amazing imaginary world. Okay, now I'm going to do a reading for you before we close from The Voyage of Don Treader. All my kids have favorites. I love them all. I love all these. But this is my daughter Anne's favorite, The Voyage of Don Treader. In fact, we had a little boat up at Whidbey Island, a little tiny 17-foot outboard, and we called it the Don Treader. Kind of pretty small boat to be called the Don Treader. The Don Treader is a sailboat. You know, it's kind of funny how it happens. This boy Eustace is a kind of a bad boy, and he's with the Provence children, his cousins. They're in the bedroom, and they see a picture on the wall of a ship, and it's a Narnian ship. And the kid said, oh, that's a Narnian ship. And he said, oh, yeah, it's so silly. What a funny-looking ship it is. And then, you know, if you read the story, then suddenly that little picture on the wall begins to get bigger and bigger and bigger, and before he knows it, this bad little boy, and Eustace is not much to brag about, he is so selfish. He's so self-preoccupied. He's so such a mean-spirited little guy. And suddenly he's on the ship in the sea with the rest of the kids. And there's Prince Caspian, and they're on the ship. And I want to tell you, that was really not a very happy thing for him, because then he gets seasick right away, and he's not happy there, and he wanted to get back to England. And you can't go back to England unless you're there now. As you know, the kids may be there for an awful long time. Of course, they're happy to be back because they know Narnia, but he doesn't. And so he is totally a bad little guy. He makes fun of Reepicheep, the little mouse. He makes fun of everybody. And when the chores come, and they're supposed to do chores, as a matter of fact, the ship had the bad storm, and so they're in bad shape when they're in one of these little islands. And they're all supposed to be doing their chores to help get the ship ready to get it seaworthy again so they go back to sea. And Caspian is trying to get everybody organized to get the ship together. And typical of a guy like Eustace, if you know anybody like that, he decides to just go off and do his own thing. I'm going to let those guys take care of that ship. I could care less. It's a boring trip anyway. And he goes up on this island. Then he has quite an adventure. When he goes up on the island, he's walking along. Believe it or not, he comes upon a kind of a lake area and sees a cave. And there's a dead dragon in the cave. And in the cave, he sees tremendous gold. Absolute jewels and everything. Treasure trove. And so he says, oh my goodness, this is so good to be true. So he goes into the dragon cave and just loads himself up. I kind of hinted at this earlier. Loads himself up with all these, because he has to carry them all back. He didn't have a backpack with him. So he's got to carry all this gold back with him. Boy, this is so great. I got to figure out a way to hide it when I get back, so these greedy Provence kids won't try to get this away from me. But I found all this gold, and then would you believe it? He falls asleep in the dragon cave. And when he wakes up with a start. His arm is hurting terribly, but he wakes up with a start, and he looks with one eye out to right, and he says, ooh, I thought there was just one dragon in here. There's a dragon over there. Ooh. He looks out the other eye. There's a dragon over on that side. And this is scary. Because here he is in this cave. A dragon on one side, a dragon on the other side. And so he says, I've got to make a break for it. So he runs like mad down to the river and to the lake. And looks in the lake. Finds out that makes a lot of noise when he runs. And he looks in the lake. Has a shock. It's a huge shock. He looks in the lake and he sees a dragon in the lake. And he realizes that what he saw on the one side was not a dragon, but was one of his wings. And on the other side, one of his wings, he has become a dragon. Like Lewis said, he didn't know stories that when you fall asleep in a dragon's cave with dragon's loot, then you fall asleep. If he had read a lot of stories, like Lewis said, if he had read more fairy stories, he would have known you should never fall asleep in a dragon's cave with dragonish thoughts. Because if you fall asleep in a dragon's cave with dragonish thoughts, you'll turn into a dragon. So he turns into a dragon. Well, and then, of course, he immediately becomes very painful because he's got these arms. But, you know, he begins to feel bad about it. He can fly now. He has a terrific appetite and needs to eat animals. So he eats some animals because he's huge. And he flies down. And finally, when the people, they're scared when they see him come up on the beach. But when they see him crying, a big tear coming out of his eyes, somebody says, you know, I think it's Eustace. So he's now a dragon, but he's become a good dragon. And so he actually does help them. He goes up and pulls a whole mast up of a tree and brings the tree to him so they can make a new mast for the sailboat. Now, that was nice. And now they all feel, you know, he's a good dragon, and he's Eustace, but he's a dragon. And now they got to get sailing. What are we going to do with him? What do we do with Eustace? Do we pull him as another, like a ship behind us? Or can he fly along with us? But then he'll get tired. And they even thought about strapping him on the ship. But he was so big, he was bigger than the whole ship itself. So they figured they couldn't strap him on the ship. And they were all feeling very, very blue about the fact that they were going to have to set sail. And they were going to have to leave Eustace behind, the dragon, who's now a good dragon. But still, he's a dragon with terrible pain in his two arms. So one day, one night, Edmund, remember Edmund from Lion, Witcher, Wardrobe? Edmund is walking on the beach, and would you believe it? There is Eustace, back to himself, on the beach. And that's where I'm going to start reading. Okay. Is that you, Edmund? Yeah, who are you, he said. Don't you know me, said the other. It's me, Eustace. By Jove, said Edmund, so it is, my dear chap. Hush, said Eustace, and lurched as if he were going to fall. Hello, said Edmund, steadying him. What's up? Are you ill? Eustace was silent for so long that Edmund thought he was fainting. But at last he said, it's been ghastly. You don't know, but it's all right now. Could we go and talk somewhere? I don't want to meet the others just yet. Yes, rather anywhere you like, said Edmund. We can go and sit on the rocks over there. I say, I am glad to see you, looking yourself again. You must have had a pretty beastly time. It's the little joke that Edmund tells. They went to the rocks and sat down looking out across the bay while the sky got paler and paler and the stars disappeared, except for one very bright one low down near the horizon. I won't tell you how I became a dragon till I can tell the others and get it all over with, said Eustace. And by the way, I didn't even know I was a dragon till I heard you guys using the word when I turned up here the other morning. I want to tell you how I stopped being one. Fire ahead, said Edmund. Well, last night, I was more miserable than ever, and that beastly arm ring was hurting like anything. Is that all right now? Eustace laughed, a different laugh than Edmund had ever heard him give before, and he slipped the bracelet easily off his arm. There it is, he said. Anyone who likes it can have it, as far as I'm concerned. Well, as I say, I was lying awake and wondering what on earth would become of me. And then, but mind you, it may have been a dream. I don't know. Go on, said Edmund, with considerable patience. Well, anyway, I looked up and saw the last thing I expected, a huge lion coming slowly toward me. And one queer thing was that there was no moon last night, and yet there was moonlight where the lion was. So it came nearer and nearer. I was terribly afraid of it. You might think that being a dragon, I should have knocked any lion out easily enough. But it wasn't that kind of fear. I wasn't afraid of it eating me. I was just afraid of it, if you can understand. Well, it came closer up to me and looked straight into my eyes, and I shut my eyes tight. But that wasn't any good because it told me to follow it. You mean it spoke? I don't know. Now that you mention it, I don't think it did. But it told me all the same. And I knew I had to do what it told me, so I got up and followed it. It led me a long way into the mountains, and there was always this moonlight over and round the lion wherever he went. And at last we came to the top of a mountain I'd never seen before. And on top of this mountain there was a garden, trees, fruit, everything. It was in the middle of it was a well. I knew it was a well because we could see the water bubbling up from the bottom of it. but it was a lot bigger than most wells, like a very big round bath, marble steps going down into it. The water was clear as anything, and I thought if I could get in there and bathe, it would ease the pain of my leg. But the lion told me I must undress first. Mind you, I don't know if it said these words out loud or not. I was just going to say, but I couldn't undress because I didn't have any clothes on, when I suddenly thought that dragons are snaky sort of things, and snakes can cast their skins. Oh, of course, I thought, that's what the lion means. So I started scratching myself, and my scales began coming off all over the place. And then I scratched a little deeper, and instead of just scales coming off, there was a whole skin started peeling off beautifully, like it does after an illness, or like a banana. In a minute or two, I just stepped out of it and could see it lying there beside me, looking nasty. It was the most lovely feeling, so I started to go down into the well for my bath. But just as I was going to put my foot into the water, I looked down and saw that I was all hard and rough and wrinkled and scaly, just as I had been before. Oh, that's all right, I said. I'll just take another smaller suit off underneath the first one, and I'll have to get it off too. So I peeled and scratched and tore again. This underskin peeled off beautifully. And out I stepped, and I left it lying beside the other one and went down to the well for my bath. Well, exactly the same thing happened again. And I thought to myself, oh dear, however many skins have I got to take off? For I was longing to bathe my leg. So I scratched away for the third time and got off a third skin, just like the two others, and stepped out of it. But as soon as I looked at myself in the water, I knew I had been no good. Then the lion said, I don't know if he spoke, but he said, you'll have to let me undress you. I was afraid of his claws, I can tell you, but I was pretty near desperate now. So I just lay down flat on my back and let him do it. And the very first tear he made was so deep that I thought it had gone right into my heart. And when he began pulling the skin off, it hurt worse than anything I had ever felt. The only thing that made me able to bear it was just the pleasure of feeling the stuff peel off. You know, if you've ever picked a scab or sore place, it hurts, but it's fun to see it coming away. I know exactly what you mean, said Edmund. Well, he peeled the beastly stuff right off, just as I thought I'd done myself the other three times, only they hadn't hurt. And there it was, lying on the grass, only ever so much thicker and darker and more knobbly looking than the others had been. And there was I, smooth and soft as a peeled switch, and smaller than I had ever been. Then he caught hold of me. I didn't like that much, for I was tender underneath now that I had no skin on. And he threw me into the water. It smarted like anything, but only for a moment. And after that, it became perfectly delicious. As soon as I started swimming and splashing, I found that all the pain had gone from my arm. And then I saw why. I had turned into a boy again. You'd think me simply phony if I told you how I felt about my own arms. I know I have no muscle. They're pretty moldy compared to Prince Caspian's. But I was so glad to see them. After a bit, the lion took me out and dressed me. He dressed you with his paws? Well, I don't exactly remember that bit, but he did somehow or other. In new clothes, the same ones I've got on now, as a matter of fact. And then suddenly, I was back here, which is makes me think that it must have all been a dream. No, it wasn't a dream, said Edmund. Well, why not? Well, there are the clothes, for one thing. And you've been, well, you've been undragoned for another. Well, what do you think it was then? Asked Eustace. I think you've seen Aslan, said Edmund. Voyage of Dawn Treader.